It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
My name is Margaret Kiljoy. I use she or they pronouns, and I do a lot of different projects. I've been an anarchist for a long time, and I do a lot of different sort of cultural work that ties into that. Probably most relevant to what we're talking about today, I run a individual and community preparedness podcast called Live Like the World is Dying. And in addition to that, I write a lot of fiction, and I'm in a bunch of bands, probably most notoriously at the moment. I'm in a band called Feminazgul, which is a feminist black metal band.
Awesome. Yeah, I was actually just thinking about that beautiful book that you made maybe like over 10 years ago. There was like a picture book that you had printed about going through parts of Appalachia and just sort of like different adventures and stuff about mountaintop removal and playing music.
Yeah, I used to do this kind of before Instagram thing where I traveled with a camera, and I was so used to self-publishing all kinds of different stuff. So I started self-publishing these like color books, these print-on-demand books. And the first one of them was basically my first time experiencing mountaintop removal in West Virginia and in Southwest Virginia. And God, I haven't thought about, it's funny because I always avoided thinking about when I was a forest defender, when I would used to live on the West Coast and tree sit and things like that. I always kind of avoided thinking about mountaintop removal because it was like too much problem. The disaster fatigue was already hitting me. I couldn't think about, it was hard enough to think about people cutting down these beautiful forests. It was even harder to imagine people blowing up mountains. And what's funny is now I've hit this new level of it where it's climate change is like that escalated again by another order of magnitude. It's so hard to wrap our heads around that we kind of want to not think about it. And I've been sort of not thinking about mountaintop removal in some ways, because as soon as you're able to not think about horrible things, your brain is like, let's pretend that's not happening.
Well, before we kind of get into other stuff, let's go back. You mentioned the podcast. It's on the Channel Zero Network, as is It's Going Down. Tell us a little bit about the project. You know, where did that come from? What was that desire to investigate everything that's kind of going on within that? And tell us a little bit about maybe some of the guests you've had on and some of the stuff you've covered.
Yeah. So Live Like the World is Dying first started right before the pandemic. I had been tossing the idea around in my head for maybe about a year because I was doing preparedness stuff and stuff that looks like kind of traditional prepping. And I didn't know a lot of other people on the left or anarchists or people who weren't right wing talking about these kinds of things. And it was kind of driving me nuts. And I thought about how I knew tons of people who like had all kinds of experience with all kinds of things. And I was like, oh, I'll just get them to talk about it. One of my favorite formats of a podcast is you find someone who knows more about that you wish you knew about and have them talk about it. And so I started the podcast, and pretty quickly after I started the podcast, it became both incredibly relevant and in some ways almost irrelevant because of the pandemic. I live off grid in a cabin and without particularly good internet access, and without at the beginning of the pandemic, without any particular electrical access. And so when the pandemic hit and, I chose to self-isolate, I wasn't able to continue my podcast, like just as it became really important. And then eventually I got enough of my stuff figured out, and we kind of understood what was going on with the virus. I could figure out what was and wasn't safe and was able to access more electricity and internet and got it started. And on the podcast, I interview, you know, I might interview someone who's like, here's how you treat a gunshot wound at a protest, because that's a thing that we have to deal with. Or I might interview someone who came back from Syria to talk about the situation there and what it means to be a revolutionary society, or even just what body armor is like, you know, and have had on guests who talk about how to make your own medication, like wet chemistry. And I want to have on more guests talking about food in the near future. I feel like there was a lot of, based on the crises that we're dealing with at different times last year, a lot of what I was focused on was a little bit more kind of tactical preparedness about how to keep ourselves safe, guns and first aid and things like that, and a lot of like protest gear. And all of that stuff is relevant and is going to continue to be relevant, but I'm hoping to take a little bit of a breath to focus a little bit more in the near future about food and water and kind of more of the basics.
Gotcha. And what we'll be talking about on this episode is sort of an anarchist take on prepping and preppers and that whole space. But before we kind of dive into that, how would you define prepping and the preppers themselves?
You know, it's funny because about half of the guests that I have on are like, I didn't want to do it because you said prepper. And I totally get that. You know, the connotations of the word prepper, you know, someone who focuses on preparedness, are entirely on this sort of right-wing conception of preparedness, which I would say would be individual preparedness above all else. And also specifically, one of the things that I like making fun of is the bunker mentality, this idea that like the way to be safe is to gather all of the things you need and surround yourself by concrete under the ground. And this is nonsensical for a thousand reasons, ethically, strategically, economically. It's just it's a bad idea. We actually need each other. We need our best resource that we have in any given bad situation is other people, with very few exceptions. It's actually really funny that we got hit with one of the only disaster scenarios where isolating is a good idea. You know, even if in societal collapse, you get together with other people instead of letting all the other people get together with other people while you're off hiding in the woods. And then that means that people are changing society without you and you have no say in it. And that's not a good idea. You know, so there's the bunker mentality and there's also this like frontiersman mentality. Both of these things are things that the United States has in droves in a very bad way, where people are like, oh, when bad things happen, I'm going to run out to the woods and conquer the woods and like build a homestead. And, you know, all of these just really unrealistic, like badly thought out ideas. But preparedness is crucial. Preparedness, the idea of being someone who is prepared or is helping the people around you be prepared is, I mean, it's absolutely essential. And for me, it just part of being alive is you just learn how to not let small things destroy what you're doing, right? That's like when you're actually good at anything, any project, any art, any organizing, any protesting, anything you do, you know, you're absolutely like going to be able to, you have to build in being prepared for things to not go exactly as you plan so that small hiccups don't ruin everything. And society, you know, like one of the things that I'm always saying is that we're all preppers now. You know, I mean, people all over the world have needed to do preparedness for a very long time, but a lot of people, not all of people, but a lot of people in the United States and in the global North have been able to avoid a lot of like needing to be prepared. And that's just starting to change, because of how completely we've destroyed, the earth and its climate. So when I talk about prepping, I just use it because it's shorthand, you know, people know it and there's a lot of negative baggage around it, but there's a lot of negative baggage around anarchist and I'm still really stubborn about that. I don't, you know, I often, if I'm feeling like saying it in longhand, I talk about how I run an individual and community preparedness podcast rather than a anarchist prepper podcast. And that, you know, I mean, it's also more accurate because the connotations people have for the word prepper are, they come from somewhere, you know, the space of preparedness is dominated by that. But it's not as dominated by that as people think from the outside. A lot of the people in preparedness are just people who are interested in preparedness. And so they look up the resources that are available. And by and large, the resources that are available tend to focus on a bunker mentality and tend to focus on this like fear of the other and all of these incredibly damaging ideas. And one of my favorite types of email I get is I get emails somewhat regularly from people who are like, they weren't leftists, but they weren't right wing and they were just interested in preparedness. And they were like, oh my God, I'm so glad I found your show because this makes so much sense. And I felt myself being pulled in the direction of this more right wing mentality just because I was interested in keeping my family safe or whatever. And I have this whole thing. Sorry. I hate when we cede ground to the right wing. I hate when we like say like, oh, well, that's tainted now. We can't talk. You know, I mean, I play black metal. A lot of people are like, oh, you can't play black metal. That's like Nazi stuff. And I'm like, the fuck it is, you know, they can't have that. Or like people who are like romanticizing pre-industrial life, right? Like Nazis do that too. I mean, they do it falsely, but I'm like, we can't let them have nice things. Nazis don't get to have nice things and they don't get to have preparedness.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up, you know, ceding ground to the right. I'm just curious, in your conception, do you feel like there is that sort of rightward shift because so much of what we see in mass media or video games is like, you know, 5 minutes after the lights out and everybody's like already dividing themselves into groups and who they're going to eat and kill and dominate.
Yeah, and it's like this like cultural meme. I remember once I was literally trapped in an elevator, which is absolutely one of my biggest fears. Claustrophobic person. I was trapped in an elevator at a nerd convention, and one of the people in the elevator was like, all right, who are we going to eat first? And no offense to that person, they're just regurgitating the like humor that's been presented to them. But I mean, the first thing I did is I was like, we're not going to talk about that kind of stuff. We're going to like stay calm, and we're like not going to like, you know, because it's like, I'm freaked out and there's other people in here are freaked out. We need to just stay calm. And yeah, there is that whole meme of that's what happens in crisis. And it's just completely untrue. And, you know, one of the things that I really like, you know, I had someone on talking about disaster studies the other day. And by the other day, I mean like several months ago. And people get together when things go bad and they like, we like worked together. And that's a very natural thing that we do, whether it's instinctual or cultural. I'm guessing it's instinctual on some level because the culture always tries to tell us this isn't what we do. All this culture we see constantly is like, you know, yeah, as soon as the lights go out, it's mayhem or whatever, right? And but I think that anyone who studies this stuff seriously or looks at this seriously or even has experienced anything in their own life, like knows on some fundamental level this isn't true. Like one of the ways I like talking about it is like, you know, when you're waiting for the bus, you don't talk to the people around you, at least in the kind of culture I grew up in. You don't really talk to strangers until the bus is like 5 minutes late. And then you and everyone at the bus stop are friends because you're talking about this thing that you're experiencing together. And if someone had information, like if someone was like, I just got called from someone and the bus is something, something, you know, it's like we'd all share that. And we would all like, and probably literally share food if like, you know, you're sitting at that bus stop and the bus is late and it's really hot out and someone passes out, you're going to give them water and things like that. Whereas if no crisis had happened and someone comes up and is like, hey, can I get some water? Like you might not give water to that stranger, you know? And I think that it's the same problem that anarchists run into. And I really try not to be conspiratorial about much of anything, but like this really vested interest in showing that power is necessary, you know, and that's like one of the reasons why historically imperialists and authoritarian communists will always, whether actively work together to crush us or like de facto work together to crush us, is because we threaten that, you know, and they need us to think that disaster tears us apart because when people know the truth, we realize that we shouldn't need disaster to just actually do for our own and take care of each other.
You mentioned, again, just kind of this right word, kind of like orientation. Mm-hmm. I find it interesting, though, that like there are so many kind of congruent, maybe parallel subcultures or like micro scenes or movements that kind of like are along the same lines, but like more oriented, like I guess in a quote left direction, like whether it's like permaculture or intentional communities or just kind of even like DIY stuff or I don't know, people that like nerd out about like, you know, pickling stuff or, you know, so there is kind of like, I find that there's like, there seems to be like a lot of overlap. It's like people like trying to like reclaim either skills that they've lost or try to just like gain more autonomy over, you know, how they get their food or their resources. I don't know, just interesting that there's like some areas where it kind of goes in this direction, but then there's also people that are almost doing the exact same thing that are like totally politically in a different direction.
Yeah, I mean, that gets into the like, the frontiersman, like mythos within the colonizer, you know, the colonizer of the U.S., right? This idea of like, you know, if you love nature, go destroy it, which just never made any sense to me, never worked for me. You know, this like I'm not telling people that they like shouldn't have four wheelers or like shouldn't have like RVs or whatever, right? But this version of like, I love going out to nature and like just to run engines and be loud and like, or I want to like go survive by clear cutting a quarter acre and, you know, like murdering everything that comes near my door. And then even like the frontiersman thing was that people would go do that and then they'd get bored once civilization catches up with them. And then they'd go be the knife's edge of that further west or whatever. And it's nasty, but it's like, and one of the things that's hard about it is that it's like, it seems like a lot of those people could be incredibly reverent of nature and incredibly interested in doing something totally different that scratches a similar itch and like hopefully better, you know. And yeah, and I hope that we're able to, I like what you're talking about when you're talking about all of the like, yeah, like the people who like, you know, DIY pickles have been part of anarchy as long as, you know, I've been doing this for about 20 years and, you know, there's always been the like, not only is it about organizing to destroy authority, it's also about fixing bicycles and things like that, you know? And I've always really liked that aspect of it. And I think that almost like the intervention that I'm hoping to do or that I feel like I'm part of or whatever is just trying to remind people that it's like, well, we need to do that. And we also need to step it up because we need to also like tie in not just like, Not just like thriving skills, but also surviving skills, you know?
We don't want to like seed kind of like the DIY, you know, basic skill space or, I don't know, everything from like, you know, wild food gathering to like herbal medicine to like the right. Because, I mean, I have seen, you know, far right groups definitely kind of go in that direction. And just like, you know, a lot of far right groups I've seen over the past year start to do like mutual aid projects. I mean, usually they're not very well organized or they're nowhere to the scale that like anarchists or other people are doing. But I mean, they do understand that that's a powerful thing for them to do. And it's something that can like help their image. And I think that if, you know, we don't kind of like inhibit that space and really kind of make it vibrant and meaningful for other people that are around us, then other folks are going to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, and we need to make sure that we're doing it in a, like, I mean, I think we have a lot of practices around avoiding gatekeeping within anarchism, but I think we need to step it up in terms of making people feel included so that instead of it being like, here's, oh, the anarchists, they're the ones who are going to feed you, instead of being like, oh, we're all going to feed us and this is an anarchistic process, you know? I think we have to, yeah, you're right, do better about kind of taking that space. And, you know, it's like the whole three-way fight thing that people talk about a lot right now. I conceptualize everything as triangles. It's kind of, it's my way of avoiding dichotomies is, thinking of things as like three distinct points and how they balance against each other. And, you know, which means that every two corners have something in common versus the other one. And so, and to me, this solves the sort of horseshoe theory thing where people are like, oh, if you go far enough right and left, it's the same thing. And that's like not true, right? It is true if you go far enough right or left, you get your guns back. But the reason for that is that it's because the left and the right are positioned against the existent neoliberalism, right? Which I don't even want to call centrism because it's its own thing, you know, and so creating, filling the need for social services outside the state is always something that will help someone who is against the existent state. And, you know, that's like basic. For a while, anarchists were really into talking about fourth generational warfare, and I wish we still talked about that kind of stuff. Talking about how, like, the way that people, you know, like winning the hearts and minds is like the way that you control space. And I know that the out west, at least, a huge rise in the Patriot movement was specifically around this. And I'm thinking right now, I'm like kind of referencing the Rural Organizing Project's book that they put out a couple years ago, kind of right before the Trump era really kicked in, I think, around the time that those people took over the bird sanctuary. I get all the dates mixed up. But, and one of the things that people were doing is that these rural communities are so devoid of resources. And so the right wing stepped in and was like, we'll basically be the sheriffs around here because there's no sheriff. And we will provide security and we will provide, you know, on some level social services and things to people out here. And it makes people loyal, you know? And it is kind of a tangent, but one of the things I also falling down this like deep rabbit hole about history and, you know, anarchist history and things. And one of the things that like the authoritarian left has always gotten wrong is that they abandoned the rural poor. They're like, oh, the rural poor is reactionary. Like Marx was like on this whole thing about France where he was like, oh, the peasants, they're not the real revolutionaries, only the proletarian in the cities are the revolutionaries or whatever. And Bakunin was like coming in being like, I don't think that's true. I think that poor people have a reason to hate the rich, you know, and we were right. And like, even, you know, and the Russian Revolution proved this again, where like, you know, all the Marxists were like, no, first we have to get rid of all of the communes. We have to get rid of the peasants and make them all industrialized workers. We need a capitalist revolution before we can have a communist one or whatever. It's nonsense. And we're doing the same thing again now when we're basically like saying like, oh, if you live in the country, then you're right wing. If you have interests that are country interests, you're right wing. And I live in the country and I'm not right wing. You know, and like my neighbors, like a lot of them probably voted for Trump, but like aren't patriots, you know, and I'm not trying to say like people who are voting for Trump, people who are enabling fascism and all of these different things. Right. But just like write off whole swaths of people. It's the same as ceding territory. It's just this crap plan ethically and strategically. And, I'm trying to like really push the like, that's what Marx was wrong about. So, hey, if you're like critical of authoritarian communism, like come over to the side of not always hating people just for being rural and poor, you know?
Let's switch gears and just kind of like start to lay out kind of like a basic outline of prepping and why should people prep and why do they? And what does that start to look like?
People prep because they need to, right? Like on the most fundamental level, I try and say that like purse snacks are prepping, you know, if you carry around ibuprofen or if you carry around tampons or, you know, any of the things you're carrying around because you might need them. That's like on some level prepping, you know, you just want to be prepared for contingencies. You know, I wasn't the only girl in my Boy Scout troop. Several of us came out, but, you know, the Boy Scout model of be prepared, you know, really sat with me. You go out to the woods and you've got matches and that's great. But what if it rains? Do you have a tarp? You know, and you live in a house with electricity and that's great. But what do you do when the grid is down? Do you have at least flashlights, if not like backup heat, you know, and just building in contingencies for when things go wrong or contingency plans for contingencies, is the fundamental concept of prepping, I think. And the way I like to think about it, again, because I like breaking things down into triangles, I spent the past year living in my house as an A-frame, and I'm sure it got into my head. Didn't get to, in some ways, I'm just the classic prepper, and that I'm like this girl who lives alone in the woods. But anyway, the triangle preparedness that I like to think about is gear, skills, and relationships. These are the three sides of prepping from my point of view. Or you could say like resources and, you know, skills and community, or there's different ways you could phrase the same ideas. And all of them intersect with each other. All of these are very important. And one of the problems that we have with most prepping stuff you'll see is it focuses on gear first, skills second, and relationships third. And they're actually all three equal, but if one of them's more equal than the others, it would be relationships. It's certainly the most underdeveloped one in terms of the literature that exists. But it's one of the ones that is a huge advantage of anyone who's done community organizing, things like that. So, because on some level, so like prepping is like having the thing in your pocket is gear, right? Knowing how to use something is skills. But then also like knowing how to organize people or get help or things like that is relationships. And so I like to try and encourage people to think about what they're good at of these things and what they can develop ahead of time and play to their strengths. Like if you've got a tech job and you make good money, but you're just a real introvert and like you don't have time to learn a lot of skills, then be someone who gathers resources. You know, be a more like traditional looking prepper, have a propane generator in your apartment building in order to, you know, set it outside on your balcony and provide power for you and your neighbors when the power goes out, right? Because propane in this case, because propane doesn't go bad, you can store it longer. It's much worse for ongoing use for a generator because it's substantially more expensive per unit, but you can store propane in a way you can't store gasoline. And, you know, or if you're like a community organizer and that's your thing, or even if like you throw parties all the time and that's your thing, like maybe focusing on relationships, like kind of keep track of who's around you and like who's prepared for what and like, and think about how you can connect people to what they might need, you know, or one of the most important things people can do in a crisis, I think, and I think is like the anarchist response in crisis is not showing up with all the socks and all the food, although that's great. But showing up with an idea of how we can organize each other collectively, right? Like if you're ever in a situation that suddenly finds itself leaderless, I've been in like social situations like this, right? Where you have like a bunch of strangers at a writing workshop and there's like no one in charge. And you're like, well, what do we do? Like, how do we hang out? Who's going to break the ice? Like be the person to break the ice. But not only that, be the person who's like in charge to make no one in charge, like present the idea of like, here's a way we can all make these decisions together collectively. And like, because people, when there's a power vacuum, people are looking not for like a strong man to come in and lead them, but for someone to suggest a way of doing things. And that way of doing things can be, I'm in charge, don't question my orders. Or it can be, let's all like figure out what we all want, what our strengths and weaknesses are, how do we move forward. And I've seen that happen. And I think anarchists did that in the Occupy movement very effectively, where, you know, all these people are like, I think we should all get together and figure things out, but we don't know how. And then it's like, you know, all the experienced consensus organizers in the country, not all of them, but huge chunk of the experienced consensus organizers in this country are anarchists. And they come in, and even if it's not an anarchist project, they will help people organize anarchistically. And so I think that that's an incredibly useful thing to focus on. And then there's skills. And then the other thing about prepping is people focus way too much on like surviving in the woods is what preparedness is. And that is like pretty unlikely. There are some circumstances where like, you know, people move across borders, right? People sometimes have to hike through the desert. People sometimes have to evade, like, you know, if there was a civil war and fascists took over your town and you had to get out of your town, you know, you might have to evade their roadblocks, in which case having a map and compass is a really good idea. Or if the entire country fell, like, you know, when, you know, Spain fell or whatever, and people had to hike into France or whatever, right? You want to know how to hike into France if you can, or how to help other people make their way into France, you know? So there is some role for this, like, kind of immediate short term. How do you filter your water? How do you hunt a squirrel? How do you do all these things? But to present another triangle I really like to think about is self, community, and society. So, you know, to talk about scale of things, right? Like, so say you're talking about water on a small scale. Maybe you have a ceramic water filter, or maybe you even just have bleach and a dropper. And I don't remember off the top of my head the number of drops per quarts of water, but you can use bleach to kill bacteria, and you should look it up before you do it. And, you know, that's your, like, immediate thing, right? But then most community preparedness people, which is more of, like, the left's approach to prepping, is, like, usually not been the bunker thing, but more like almost like the homestead level, which is also great, but also limited, will be like, how do we set up large rainfall catchment? And how do we, you know, divert this creek or this river in order to provide water for the people who live here? And that's also really great. But people also forget about the society-wide level, which is also vital, where it's like, okay, we've got that figured out. Now, how do you get water to communities outside your own immediate community or your larger community, you know? And how do you organize, like, you know, you can organize yourself to refuse authority, and you can organize your community to be resistant to it. But we also need to organize society to be resistant to authority. You know, it's like, so we also need revolution. And I don't know, I use triangles in order to map out what I value. That's my short answer after my long answer.
Els fills de l'avarícia que ens heu anat sembrant, cridem des de les ombres de la vostra capital. Començaran les hòsties, no sabreu d'on us vindran. Veureu com és la vida que ens havíeu preparat. Forgem una altra història, deixem de contemplar com els nostres drets moren a les vostres mans. No canviaran les coses si no canvies tu. Estima la utopia igual que el barri on has nascut. Seguim aquí on vam néixer. Seguim aquí aguantant. Per la supervivència. La fe a despertar. Potser un dia vols creure. Presses de la por, són llum que il·lumina quan es faci fosc. Aquelles que curen allò que fa mal, que fem amb les cendres quan tot s'ha cremat.
El vent, la cara sempre al vent, de la mansaga fem. Sembla que ens ofeguem, però l'amor ens fa valer.
Seguim aquí on vam néixer.
Seguim aquí on vam néixer.
Seguim aquí aguantant.
So for people that are listening to this, we've been kind of having like an open theoretical discussion. What are some things that they could do to like begin prepping that that would make sense? Like if you were going to like tell somebody some advice, especially looking at sort of the disasters we're seeing unfolding right now. We've got like hurricanes, you know, off the coast of Florida. We have wildfires and like heat waves over across the West Coast. What are some things that you're seeing play out right now that you think people should actively be preparing for or gathering supplies? And what would that look like?
Mm-hmm. So everyone's going to, on some level, know their own threat model. And I would encourage you to look at your threat model. Look at the things that seem likely to happen and try to throw away the things that are not as likely to happen. Don't think about them as much, right? Threat modeling comes up a lot with like, for example, whether or not you want to own a firearm is a very complicated decision. And your threat modeling isn't just like, you know, what is more likely? Are you more likely to be in a situation in which owning a gun makes the state very, very angry at you and hurt you? Are you in a situation where owning a gun is dangerous to yourself or your loved ones because of either, you know, someone's mental health or someone's like age and ability to understand what they should and shouldn't do? You know, You always want a threat model. And so when you prepare, there's certain stuff that's like just always worth having, right? It is always worth having an emergency blanket, a lighter, some stockpiled food, some stockpiled water, ways of filtering water. If you are personally comfortable with like have any experience with any kind of like hunting or fishing or gathering, the like skill, the tools with which to do that. There's certain things that I would really recommend everyone have, and I'll get into those more in a second. But instead, basically be like, well, I'm prepping for fire, or I'm prepping for authoritarian takeover, or, you know, increasing takeover, whatever. Or I'm preparing for flooding and hurricanes. You know, you're going to have different things. And with fire, you know, a lot of the things are, you know, again, it's going to depend on where you live, right? But a lot of things are around like clearing the area around your house, making sure that you have a lot of water on hand. There's a lot of specifics actually that, an anarchist wilderness firefighter goes into on podcast from last summer, which I won't remember all of exactly. So I don't want to like give anyone wrong information, but there's like simple stuff like treat your gas tank half empty, meaning empty. So you always fill your gas tank before it's half empty. So that way you always have enough gas for an evacuation. When fires are closer, you also are going to point your car out of the driveway if, you know, you're in a space with a driveway and things like that. Knowing who's around you and what they would need in emergency, like, do you like need mobility assistance? Does your neighbor need mobility assistance? How are you going to talk to them and provide that for them when that happens? You know, like maybe preparedness looks like the next vehicle you get is a wheelchair accessible van, you know, or like just start thinking about preparedness in terms of the other things you do. Like when you pick a vehicle, you know, there's pros and cons to any type of vehicle. Like in a lot of situations, a plain old boring sedan with a locking trunk is like really useful. You know, in other situations, you want a pickup truck, but maybe it gets terrible mileage. Like, you know, and if you're worried about access to gas, that's going to be a problem. So there's always going to be like balances. But overall, I think the thing that I really want people to do is look at the things that they use in their day-to-day life and how they would get by without access to those for a week and how they can mitigate that. You know, there's some stuff where it's like, yeah, if there's a wildfire and you need to evacuate, that's what you got to do, right? But there's other stuff where it's like, well, maybe there's a wildfire the next town over and you can't go outside because of the smoke, or, you know, the food chain has been disrupted a little bit and you can't get toilet paper. So just have some toilet paper around ahead of time, you know, and get the stuff before it's necessary. We're coming up on crisis time in terms of fire out west, but I believe that box fans and air filters and things like that are still reasonably readily accessible. And get a half mask respirator or get a full face gas mask, you know, and ideally you want P100 filters that filter out 100% of particulates and are oil proof, although I'm actually not personally certain how important the oil proof is for wildfire smoke. It's not something that I've had to deal with nearly as much as a lot of other people I know. Get all that stuff now while you still can, and get it. One of the reasons that you get this stuff, because, you know, I'm like, well, I talk about community preparedness. What's the point of having the individual preparedness? The point is that you have it so that you don't need someone else to give it to you in the time of crisis. It's like being like, well, I'm good. What do we all need? So that you can step up better if you're already taken care of for yourself. It's applying your own gas mask before you apply other people's, but still being there to apply other people's mask, to use that tired airplane metaphor. And there's also some stuff that's like, and then so there's like skills that are worth having, right? It's always worth having more first aid skills. It's also always worth developing, you know, like be a lifelong learner. Like, do you already know how to drive a car? That's great. Do you know how to ride a motorcycle? Do you know how to do evasive driving in a car? Do you know how to drive heavy equipment? You know, there's times where people have had to take bulldozers and clear the road because everyone abandoned their vehicles in the middle of the road and no one could get out of the town as a wildfire was approaching or whatever. And, you know, so just like do these things. But okay, the other thing I would want to say about any prepping you're doing, one of the main points of prepping is to worry less, not more. It's like really easy to start getting fixated on all these things that can go wrong and just start freaking out about them. But if you look at a likely problem and you do kind of the best you can to solve it ahead of time, you can trick your brain into forgetting about that problem. It's not, some people can do that more easily than others, but you can trick your brain into being like I have, if there's a wildfire in the forest I'm in, I have my bag ready to go that I will take with me and leave. So I should stop worrying about forest fire now because there's nothing else realistically that I can do because I'm not going to clear 100 yards around my cabin in every direction, you know?
That goes into our next question. I mean, people hear a lot about go bags or bug out bags.
I have a go bag. I think go bags are a little bit of an overrated concept than prepping. They're worth having, especially actually out west where fires are a very serious concern. Overall, your home for most people who have like permanent shelter and, you know, aren't stuck living in tents and various other situations, your home is going to be your best place to like bug out to run away to. You don't run away in most scenarios. You actually stay home, shelter in place. And which is good because you have access to a lot more stuff there. Even if it's like, well, if your electricity is off, the water is off, etc. But you could keep gallons of water, or if at home, you could easily keep five, depending on the size of your home, all of these different things, keep 5 gallon jerry cans of water. Or in my situation, since I live off grid, I have, you know, multiple 50 gallon drums out in front of my house full of water. And you can scale things based on your need. But if you're going around in a backpack, you're probably only going to have a couple quarts of water. And so go bags are useful, but they're I think a little bit overrated. My personal philosophy is actually it's built on you start with everyday carry, which is the stuff that's like just on you at any given point. And there's going to be slightly different stuff for anybody. But for me, if I'm wearing something with pockets, I have my keys, my wallet, my phone, of course. There's a multi-tool, a tiny multi-tool on my keychain. I like the Gerber Dime personally. You know, you can use that for lots of weird small stuff. You never think you need a tool until you start carrying it, and then all of a sudden you use it all the time. I also carry a flashlight. I like the small tactical flashlights. They're actually one of the most useful self-defense items, not for hitting people with, although they're like built so that you can like punch with them or whatever, but literally just for blinding people. And you don't need like strobe form or whatever. You just need to be able to press the button on the back and have a really bright light shine. And you point it in someone's eyes. And if it's at all nighttime or whatever, and you shine in someone's eyes, they're going to be disoriented for a second. And that gives you time to run away or attack, depending on what you're trying to do. Probably, I think, the most important self-defense tool is a small handheld flashlight. And also useful for people of different sizes and abilities and things like that. I also carry a pocket knife, like a folding pocket knife. If I'm walking around in a miniskirt, I often carry a big knife because it's legal where I live to carry a knife, which is just any knife big enough to tell people to by its presence. I carry a full-size multi-tool often. And then personally, because I sometimes go armed, I also carry a tourniquet. And I often carry now the tourniquet, whether or not I'm going armed. It's a very small use case where you need a tourniquet, but those use cases of, you know, serious wound to your extremities can carry really quick. And guns are more and more of a threat for more and more people in the United States right now. So I think is worth carrying. So that's like the like just pockets, right? Sometimes I'll have like a little credit card multi-tool and in my wallet. And then what I really like is having an emergency kit rather than a whole go bag, because I want to have this on me all the time. You start reading like prepper things. They're like, okay, you need your go bag, and then you need your get home bag that's in your car. And then you need your bag and your other thing, and you need the other bag and you need the other bag. And what I do is I take a pouch. I use a slightly larger than these like military tactical pouches, like first aid pouches, basically. And I stuff that full of anything that is like small, light, cheap, that I use on a regular basis. And you can make slightly smaller ones with, you know, you cut out, you know, you don't put paracord in it or whatever, you know, you cut out some of the larger objects that might be in it. And there's all kinds of just tiny stuff that you can put into these kits. And then you just keep it in your backpack, or if you don't carry a backpack, you keep it in the trunk of your car, or, you know, you just like keep it on you or near you at any given point. And then no matter what, I'm going to have near me things like an emergency blanket, water filtration pills. I carry a compass in mine. Okay, so it's three different things, because everything is triangle, sorry. It's a first aid kit, it's a hygiene kit, and it's a survival kit. And the things that I use the most in it are like my hygiene stuff. You know, if I go stay somewhere and I forget my toothbrush, I have a tiny folding toothbrush and some toothpaste on me at any given point. You know, and I'll have some floss, which you can double as cordage in necessary in emergency. You can also sew with it. I'll keep some sewing needles, because sewing needles are light and cheap and useful. I'll keep moist towelettes. I'll keep ibuprofen. I'll keep, personally, I keep famotidine because of heartburn issues. You know, and these aren't, they're never my like, oh, I need an ibuprofen, I'm going to go to my emergency kit. These are always the like, crap, I don't have access to my usual source of this. Fortunately, I have it. You know, I don't use it, my like hand sanitizer that's in there, as my hand sanitizer, unless I am completely screwed and forgot my hand sanitizer or whatever. And I really like this style of kit, and I just make them and give them away. I put up a YouTube video of like explaining everything that I keep in mind personally, and the comments are full of people with other really good ideas of what they put into them. So then above that, you have a go bag or a camping bag, or, you know, just a larger bag, right? That has more, for me, I live in the woods, so it's like more like camping type stuff, right? If I live in a city, it might be slightly different. Although when I used to urban camp a lot, I used to live out of a backpack for most of my 20s. And, you know, I would sleep on rooftops and creeks behind strip malls and things. There's a lot of the same stuff that you're using on a daily basis. It's less like tents, and it's more like sleeping bags, sleeping pads. Though I used to use cardboard. Now I'm old and far prefer sleeping pads. And a better water filter. I don't like the chemical water filtration as much as a ceramic filter. So I use like a Sawyer style ceramic filter. I relied on it for months at the beginning of the pandemic to filter my water for drinking and bathing. And so I keep a bag like that. And then that's going to be really different depending on your purpose. It's basically just like, you think about what might go wrong. And like, you know, I think about how, like, I feel like an idiot that I always drove around without a tire plug kit. You know, I didn't realize that most punctures in your tire, you can fix yourself for like $5 with a tire plug kit that's tiny and it fits in your trunk. It's way smaller than a spare tire, although you should have a spare tire if you can. You know, and like, just making sure you have a car jack, and making sure you have, you know, how many times have you locked yourself out of a car? Just make sure you keep a spare key magneted to it somewhere. You know, how many times have you let your battery die? And so not only just keep jumper cables, but if you can afford it, keep one of those little jumper boxes in your car, and that's a really good backup battery. Oh, another thing to keep in as many of these things as possible is like backup batteries and, you know, keeping your cell phone charged. People are like, I've posted things about like keeping your cell phone charged, and people are like, oh, what are you going to be doing, playing video games on your phone? And I'm like, well, first of all, maybe. I've lived alone in off-grid a lot, and I can tell you the importance of morale. You know, My Nintendo Switch was very important to me at the beginning of this pandemic. So having that kind of stuff around, and then at a home level, yeah, you might want, I would say personally the best thing for the most different types of people, most environments, it's a little bit pricier than some other options, is to get it's called a solar generator. And it's basically a giant lithium battery with a lot of like inputs and outputs, and you can keep it charged from your house. And then if power goes out, you have like a lot of power in this like large power bank, but they're also designed that you can plug in solar panels and charge them. And as you discovered, solar panels are not half as effective as the people claim they are. You know, it's like I have 1200 watts in front of my house, which is, you know, 12 decent sized solar panels. And in the sun, I'm maxing out at 800 watts, but most of the time I'm getting like 250 watts, things like that. And so if you get like your 50 watt, also these numbers are meaningless to people who I only had to learn all this stuff because of solar. Having a solar panel can make a big difference. And even that little camping one that you probably got, it probably can charge your phone or at least keep your phone from dying. Just not happily or easily. You know, it's like the kind of thing where it's like if you hike all day, you might be able to turn on your cell phone long enough to send out a message, which is maybe the difference between life and death. So they're not useless, and I actually keep one of those little terrible folding solar panels in my bag, but it doesn't have any purpose in my house. I tried setting it up, you know, when I didn't have any other electricity, and it wasn't doing anything meaningful.
You're listening to It's Going Down, part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. If you appreciate this podcast and this project, please go to itsgoingdown.org/shop and sign up to donate monthly or give us a one-time donation. Without your support, It's Going Down cannot continue. We depend on your financial contributions and solidarity to keep doing this project week in and week out. Please go to itsgoingdown.org/shop and support us. Let's get back to it.
You know, whether from hurricanes rocking Puerto Rico to massive wildfires, as we said, I'm just curious your thoughts, you know, really on the present situation. And how do you see things playing out over the next couple of years?
Well, you'd be shocked to know that I think things are going to get a lot worse. You know, I remember at one point when I was being very doom and gloom, maybe 10, 15 years ago, my dad was like, you know, every generation thinks the world's going to end with them, right? And I thought about that a lot. And it kind of tempered some of my, not enthusiasm, but conviction that the world might be ending. And then a couple years later, my dad was like, you know, all the fish in the ocean are about to be dead. You know, and so it's like he came around, right? And then the other thing is that all these generations that thought that the world was going to end with them, most of them were right. The world could have ended with them. And also the end of the world is a process, not a moment. And it's also very unevenly distributed. And the world has ended for many, many people and cultures, you know, as a white person living in North America, I live in a post-apocalyptic wasteland, right? And so, but I do think that climate change is going to be substantially more impactful than people want to let themselves believe. You know, you all were talking about that book Desert, and there's that book Desert that came out, I don't know, 10 years ago or so, from a group of people looking at what it means that there's going to be this massive ecological crisis and how it might, and they present some ideas about how it might shift power and the cracks between the pavement that it might offer to resilient folks to try and make something new. And it was presented as this like green nihilist text, this like very doom and gloom text. And honestly, like I read it and I was like, I think that this is so optimistic, it's almost not useful. Like, because it's talking about habitable space and there's still being a lot of it. Very different, right? It's about talking about the desertification of large areas of space. Now, that said, I'm wrong about stuff all the time. And I really hope I'm wrong about this one. But I personally think, it's, you know, people don't want to hear it, but, you know, I think, I think we need to learn to enjoy our lives because they might not continue. Just straight up, you know? And they might. Like, I try to break down, actually, this one isn't into threes, this isn't a fours. I try to break down my planning based around what might happen. One, we might be able to stop the end of the world. Two, we might all die in the end of the world. Three, the world might continue on. Actually, I don't remember what the fourth is, so maybe it's accidentally three. Or the world might continue along the way it is, right? And so if we're doomed, we need to learn to live our lives and enjoy them as best as we can. If there's a chance to stop this, we need to do that. Oh, okay, I remember the fourth one. The other is like, it might happen despite us trying to stop it, but we can survive it, right? And then the fourth one is things might continue the way they are, which is, of course, you know, its own disaster for a lot of people, but substantially nicer for a lot of people. And so don't put all your eggs into the world is ending basket, and don't put all your eggs into the you're just going to die basket, and don't put all your eggs into any of these baskets. I think that if nothing else, these crises like the heat dome are going to become increasingly regular, and it will be an interesting thing to see if global capitalism, which is remarkably hardy and has survived a lot of things, if it will survive this particular, you know, worldwide thing. I think the other thing that we're going to have to worry about is essentially the bunker mentality writ large is the nationalistic idea. It's the idea of, we got ours, so to hell with you. You know, it's the idea of building walls to stop climate refugees. And I think it's a bad idea. I think if you were to take two cities and one of them takes all comers and one of them, it like holds themselves up and doesn't let anyone in or is very, very selective. I think that in the short term, the one that takes in all comers is going to have a few disadvantages, and long term, it's going to be substantially better. Like, even from an economic point of view, people make the economy, right? Labor produces all wealth, all of these things, you know? The more people you have in your society, the better off you can be if they're organized, if we are organized well, versus closing up your borders. But I think people are going to become, I think we're going to see a rise in fascism that we will not defeat as, and I say this not blithely, that we will not defeat as easily as we defeated the rise of fascism in the 30s and 40s, because the underlying cause will not be addressed when we successfully defeat fascism this next time, which I believe we will. But because the underlying cause won't be addressed, I think it'll keep getting worse. Or keep coming up. I do think that there's a lot of hope. I think that there's a lot of ways in which finding cracks in what's happening is very beautiful. I think that moving towards a society of mutual aid is, you know, I mean, it's the bright side of the pandemic, right? But I hate talking about the bright side of a pandemic because it's not right to talk about, you know, to focus on the silver lining of a very dark cloud, except to help point out to people that, like, all is not lost and it's still worth trying to do things. I don't know. My last name's Killjoy and I earned it. But I'm trying to move away from telling teenagers they're never going to live to be as old as me. So maybe we can all pull together and get this done. But if we're going to pull together and get things done, we have to face it. We can't continue to believe that electoral change could, I'll put this as like politely as possible, electoral change is certainly not moving at a rate that is fast enough to address these issues. But I also think it's reasonable that people look at revolution as having a really, really bad track record and often makes things a lot worse. So that's why my hope is in the expansion of mutual aid societies and not mutual aid societies, mutual aid organizations, things like that.
Well, let's go on to a little more hopeful question, I guess, is that, you know, in the past year, there's no doubt that anarchists have been deeply involved in a lot of mutual aid projects. I mean, there's just been some really inspiring work, and there continues to be not only people responding to kind of the start of really entrenched, really climate change caused problems, but also just people responding to other disasters as well. But I'm just curious, do you think that anarchists could basically not only approach responses to climate change, not only like in things like, you know, fighting Line 3 or disaster relief, but also in this avenue of prepping, which would also then, you know, take space away from the right? And I'm curious, you know, what would that look like?
Yeah, I think that we do need to do that. I think that we do need to, you know, because part of the prepping that I teach about, like, teach is not the right word, explore with people, is community preparedness, and especially like social preparedness. And, you know, because it's all the same thing, right? It's because preparedness is not just 5 gallon buckets of rice. That is not how you stop the end of the world. Reforesting large swaths of the earth is how we do it, and is, you know, is part of how we do it. And that can happen in a decentralized manner through either direct action, or what would always end up being direct action. The question is whether or not it's like illegal direct action. You know, we can make changes to our climate in positive ways, at least on a microclimate level, and build up, you know, build up so many actions that it has larger effect. And I think that's all part of preparedness. You know, I think that in addition to be able to like weather certain interruptions in service or whatever, we also need to look about rebuilding different. You know, there's I find a lot of hope in cooperative economics, and there's been this whole move to basically all these businesses that shut down to reopen them as cooperatives, right? And get rid of the bosses, get people like organizing horizontally. Cooperatives are very often involved in local mutual aid efforts, because even though they're existing within a capitalist economy, at least the cooperatives that I'm excited about, like, don't, that's not their focus, is competing in a capitalist system, but instead, you know, feeding people or whatever it is that the co-op is interested in. I do think that we can build all of these things together and build back different and come back different. And I definitely think it's useful for us to, I mean, it's not even like taking space away from the right wingers. The right wingers are not doing anything useful as preparedness people, by and large. On an individual level, they're, you know, in a family level and sometimes a sort of compound level, they're holding up with guns and resources, and, you know, and that's absolutely going to have an impact on things, and it shouldn't be written off. Although I actually wouldn't write off all of those individuals and compounds and things like that. Like your neighbor whose garage is full of beans and rice, I bet you he'll share, you know, more likely than not. Especially if you approach politely, and especially if you talk to him ahead of time. But we actually occupy this space more effectively already, because we do it on a community and social level, and we just tend not to do it as much on an individual level, which is ironic, you know, because people always accuse us of being individualists, but the current conceptions of mutual aid projects, you know, at least where I live and where I'm from, largely are coming from anarchist spaces. We're obviously influenced by things that would not call themselves anarchists. But yeah, I think we can do that. And, you know, encouraging individual preparedness is just kind of it's almost a way to just get people talking about it, you know, and get it so that we can have that be a base to build people up also to the community and social level of preparedness.
Well, any other thoughts that we didn't cover? Are there any other avenues of this we haven't looked at?
Yeah, one of the things I want to talk about with preparedness is that a lot of people, when I talk about preparedness, they feel like they can't. You know, they're like, well, I'm not, you know, able-bodied. I'm surrounded by people who are very opposed to my existence based on, you know, some identity marker. You know, people have very good reasons to see the space of prepping as this exclusive and privileged space. I'm poor is a very important one of these things, you know. And I really want to encourage people to think about preparedness not just in these like terrible ableist terms of like, how am I going to hike 30 miles by myself? Anyone who can't keep up with me is, you know, dead to me or whatever, right? But instead, thinking about how, you know, the slogan or cliche we use is we keep us safe, right? And I'm in almost every situation safer with someone else near me than by myself. And so community preparedness isn't just about making your community prepared in terms of like these infrastructural projects or whatever, right? But instead about thinking about things from a community point of view and thinking about if you're gathering resources, you're gathering them to share. And because, you know, if I have the option of having a $50 headlamp or me and, you know, a $60 headlamp or me and two other people have a $20 headlamp, if the $20 headlamp is almost as good, which it usually is, I would rather that two other people I know have headlamps. It, even from a pure self-interest point of view, if the people around me are safer and more capable, I'm in a better situation. And I want to encourage people to think about things in those ways. And then also think about the things that you do have to offer that seem outside of the traditional prepping sphere. And, you know, someone who's good at telling stories is incredibly useful. You know, someone who's like old enough to have just experience and like relate the things that have happened in the past so that, you know, if everything is a science experiment, they've seen more iterations of the experiment and they can like report back on what has happened and what works. There's always something, I think, that people would have to offer. And I think that it also, one of the things, if you're an outgoing person, one of the things that you could have to offer is talking to people and helping them see these things about themselves. That's been on a interpersonal level, one of the most important. I mean, don't be an arrogant, you know, don't be a jerk about it, but like helping people see the ways in which they can do things, because a lot of people are like, I mean, a lot of anarchists my age don't love going to demos anymore because we're all shell-shocked. And actually probably a lot of young anarchists don't want to go to demos anymore because we're all shell-shocked, right? And, you know, helping people see that they're still useful is one of the most useful things of all. I don't know. It's cheesy, but I think that matters more than how many buckets of beans and rice you have, which I have a lot of. It's easier. It's much easier to just solve things through buying things. I don't know if you knew this.
How can people follow your work?
You can follow me. I'm on Twitter at MagpieKilljoy, Instagram at MargaretKilljoy. I'm on Patreon for now as patreon.com/MargaretKilljoy. And I publish a zine every month, although I'm terribly behind from the pandemic. I haven't caught up yet. And there's about 40 some zines up there. Also, if you make less money, if you live off of less money than I make on Patreon, just contact me and I'll give you all my work for free. All the work that's Patreon locked for free. And if you, you know, my main band is Feminaz Ghoul. I also do a solo dark pop project called Nomadic War Machine, and I'm in a anti-fascist neo-folk band called Ulcerith, and I'm in a synth pop dark wave band called The Lathe, and I have a solo doom metal project called Vulgarite. I do a lot of different stuff. I sort of obsessively produce things. And I write fiction, including it'll probably be announced by the time this comes out. AK Press is republishing my anarchist utopian book, A Country of Ghosts, at the end of this year for part of a new series of anarchist fiction. And I have all of these ideas if you ever want to talk about what the point of utopia is and the point of cultural change and giving people ideas is. And yeah, and that's coming out and you could read that. I mean, you can actually read it now because it's already out. They're just doing a new edition. The old one was by a now defunct publisher. But that is how to follow me.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.